welcome to That Spooky. I'm Johnny.
And I'm Tyler.
And this is a weekly podcast that's starting to run out of Halloween references now that we can't talk about Thriller anymore. Thanks, Michael Jackson.
Yeah, thanks, Michael Jackson.
Yeah, we really fucking love your legacy, dude. All right, so let's just move on from that.
Uh-huh.
We're back.
We're back. Back for real this time.
Yeah, no, yeah. Episode 51 was one that we recorded just moments before we went back home to Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. Literally hours before we left.
Yeah, and it was a good time. We were home for the first time in 3 years. I was there for a week. You were there for 2 weeks. And now we are back. We are in Toronto. We are loving life. We are with our weird little dog and our needy black cat.
Uh-huh.
And life is good.
It is.
Yeah. Although I will say apologies for last week's episode being so devastatingly late to be released. This is a funny little story. So I didn't know that your flight can just be canceled by text message 2 hours before you leave.
I know, right?
Yeah, I learned that. And they rescheduled me for a day and a half later.
Uh-huh.
So let's just say I didn't get back at 9 a.m. on Monday morning. I got back at about 6 o'clock on Tuesday evening, which meant that was the time I was able to access the stuff to edit the episode, which meant that we didn't actually get to release until Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a real bummer. Thanks for that, Porter Airlines.
Hashtag not sponsored.
Yeah, but a big thank you to our friend, who is also a spooky bitch, Alyssa, who housed Sad for us and stayed with Fleetwood and Behemoth.
Yes, our pets were well looked after, and we were so appreciative of that.
Yeah, and now they have a new aunt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was real nice. We're back, but you know what happened while we were gone, Tyler?
What?
Dracula.
I know, it keeps getting released when it's not supposed to.
I know, right? So, let's talk about that now. So we're into spooky gay bullshit, and we have to do 2 minutes of Dracula. We have two episodes to talk about.
6 and 7.
Sure.
So with episode 6, the show is back on track as they challenge the contestants to create horror hospital looks.
Oh yeah, an alternative press magazine was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're still around. That's cool.
Uh-huh. AP Press. Hey y'all.
Hey 90s. All right, so do you have any real thoughts or feelings about this episode? Because all to y'all, Shane, I don't really think that much happened in here. We did get some backstory on Lou.
We did get some backstory on Lulu.
Which I really appreciated. Mm-hmm. I am loving Louisiana Purchase more and more as every episode goes by. In fact, I would not be mad if Louisiana Purchase won this, even though Landon Sider is probably going to win this.
Yeah, that's what I think, but I'd be happy with both. But yeah, not too much happened on this episode other than just some pretty cool looks. I really loved Landon Sider's look, where they looked kind of like Reanimator.
Oh yeah, it was so good.
Mm-hmm, I really loved that. And I mean, Lulu looked really good too as this kind of like weird zombie candy nurse.
Yeah, candy striper, candy nurse.
Uh-huh.
I love it. And she's just a nurse giving out candy.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, that leg's broken, gumdrops.
Yeah. Oh, you're feeling sick? Have a lolly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I liked it. I really appreciated having Millie What's-Her-Fuck there from Hereditary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, her. She was a really good judge.
She was. Yeah, smart kid.
Yeah, she read Eve of Destruction for those tights. And that was well-deserved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, spoiler alert, we had to say goodbye to Madeline Hatter.
Which I was sad to see, but also completely understood, and it was definitely her time to go.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm just gonna miss her little antics, you know?
I know. She made these earrings.
Yeah, I'm gonna miss that whiny baby voice.
Yeah, me too. Alright, so that's episode 6, and then episode 7 happened. Uh-huh. It just came out.
Yeah, well, again, it came out early.
Yeah.
But in episode 7, they had to create, basically, like, freak show circus looks.
And it was good, mm-hmm. And even though I can't stand Dahlia Black, I have to give it to her. She looked like a puppy teeth illustration.
Yeah.
It was really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. She did this kind of wackadoo old cartoon weightlifter freakazoid illusion. I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of had Can I Speak to the Manager hair on at the end, and it worked.
It did work.
Yeah.
And speaking of working, I really loved Lulu's look as well. They kind of read her for the performance, but the look was on point. She was like a three-breasted woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking like old school Vampire Total Recall. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Three titty tassels.
Yeah, I'm into it. And then, spoiler alert, we say goodbye to Eve of Destruction, which I'm not mad at.
I was not mad at.
No!
I felt like it was her time.
Yeah, bye-bye, Eva, whatever. But like, oh my god, Louisiana Purchase during that extermination challenge.
I know.
I wanted to hug her.
Mm-hmm. She needed a hug.
Yeah. Oh my god, watch it. She faints.
And then, I mean, we can't get into it, but there was a lot of drama in episode 7, too, between Priscilla Chambers and Dahlia Black. Ooh.
yeah, get onto the Secret Society. We'll talk about it on there.
Eventually.
At some point. All right. So that is Dragula. Anything else to add?
Nothing more.
Cool. All right. So before we really get into this show this week, I have one more piece of spooky gay bullshit to talk about.
Okay.
Now, we do have a little bit of backlog of stuff to go over in spooky gay bullshit, so bear with me. But this one was real fucking good. And this was sent to us a little while ago by Casey on Instagram. So this story comes out of the Daily Mail. It was posted by Ben Ashford. It was actually published on September 23rd of 2019.
All right.
Yeah, and it was recently updated. So there's some breaking stuff going on with this case. I invite you all to Google it after we're done talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But this article surrounds this couple, or they were a couple at the time. They're not anymore. Christine and Michael Barnett. So around 2010, I think, or something like that, like not very long ago, they adopted a six-year-old girl. Now, she was a Ukrainian orphan. Her name was Natalia Grace, and it was a pretty quick adoption. Like, it was kind of an emergency situation. From what I understand, it was just presented to them very quickly. It was just kind of like, hey, do you want this girl? Not much backstory. See you later. Bye.
Right, like door-to-door child salesman.
Well, basically, just this girl had to be rehomed as quickly as possible because we are to assume that she had just been dumped by a family.
Right.
Like a sack of potatoes. Now, the thing is, that's a sad story. I'm kind of being bleak about it. There's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
The long and the short of it is that once they adopt this six-year-old girl in like 2010, Christine and Michael start to notice some weird shit going down. Basically, the six-year-old girl is acting very fucking strange. She doesn't really want to interact with the other little kids. She wants to talk to teenagers that she goes to school with. She wants to talk to the adults when she's at home.
Okay.
She doesn't really have the interests of a six-year-old, and her vocabulary is a little bit above what they would expect a six-year-old Ukrainian orphan to possess.
Right.
They also kind of clocked that she didn't really have that much of an accent. But at the time, they were just kind of like, well, you know, like, we're just two folks from Indiana. Like, who the fuck knows? Like, maybe when you move from another country, you shed that accent real quick when you're a little kid. Like, right. They don't know the nuance of this kind of stuff.
Sure.
They're just rolling with the punches. Now, that's a little bit weird. It gets a little bit weirder because once they start living with this girl and interacting with her, like, you know, she's a six-year-old kid. She knows how to dress herself.
Mm-hmm.
But once the time comes where they do see her naked, they realize, wow, this six-year-old girl has quite an impressive amount of pubic hair.
Okay.
Now, I'm not here to talk about the junk of a child,
mm-hmm.
but they also started to notice in her clothing that a lot of blood was showing up, which indicated to them that their six-year-old child was on a menstrual cycle.
Right.
Which is a little overachieving for a six-year-old, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So this started to make Christine and Michael kind of question what was going on. Well, that plus the fact that this six-year-old child was trying to kill them.
What?
Yeah, so...
Wait.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this a movie?
Yeah, it's called Orphan.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Get into it. So Christine and this child, Natalia, are out for a walk one day, and Natalia tries to push Christine into an electric fence.
Oh.
Yeah. So she's like, that's a little bit weird. Then there's also another instance where Natalia was like alone in the other room with the kids, like playing, and through the baby monitor, Christine just hears like severe beating, and she goes in the room and just finds this six-year-old just wailing on her other children.
Oh my God.
And her other children were a little bit older too. Like, she had this one genius kid who had actually written like scientific papers between the ages of 12 and 15.
The
like
fuck?
Yeah, no, like that's the thing. Like, they had like a real rockin' family. Christine has written books on like parenting a child with autism that has exceptional intelligence and stuff like this. Like, you know, this isn't just like Betty and Joe Beercan and who knows where Wyoming. These were people who had raised a bunch of other kids without any incident. From what I understand, the kids were actually pretty like hands off and docile. So this adopted child was just raising hell in this family. To add to the situation, there was another instance in the first year where Natalia tried to poison Christine's coffee with bleach. Yeah, she tried to poison the family, and then she once threatened to stab the entire family in their sleep.
Ooh.
Yeah, and they're like, wow, yeah, that's a little bit much for a six-year-old orphan.
Right, yeah, I mean, who knows what she went through prior to that, but there are a lot of red flags there.
Exactly. But after all of this stuff started piling up, Christine and Michael just started to get real freaked out. So they ended up taking Natalia into a bunch of specialists and having her tested out, both psychologically and physically. And basically what the doctors ended up telling the parents away from Natalia was that they believed that she was actually born sometime around 1989.
Oh my God, me too.
Yeah, which at the time would have made her about 21 to 23 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Not a 6-year-old child. So they actually believed that she was an adult with dwarfism who was passing as a child, and it scammed her way into getting adopted. And then the family kind of goes, aha, so maybe this is why the last family dropped her so quick and they needed her to be gotten rid of.
Right.
So basically the family figures this out, but there's no recourse that they feel that they can take at the time. So they pay for an apartment to put Natalia in. They just kind of approach her and they're like, look, the jig is up. Like, we know what you're doing. And she's just kind of like, okay. And they put her in an apartment that they pay for, they furnish, and they're trying to, you know, get her on food stamps, you know, like put her life together and kind of set her off on her own, which is a very noble thing to do for somebody that could have potentially just scammed you.
And tried to kill you.
Exactly. But here's the thing. She is put in this apartment. The family is just kind of like, wow, well, glad that we're rid of this potential scammer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the family at this point, because they have this gifted son, they decide to move to Canada so that he can attend a private school.
Right.
Now, when the family moves to Canada, that means that they've left Natalia in this apartment in Lafayette, Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
Which, once the police find out about this, they're not so happy. And they end up charging the family with abandoning a child.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So basically, this all ends up going to court. And even though it had been proven in court before, like privately, that it was believed that Natalia was actually a 23-year-old, basically they did bone density tests on her and then deduced from that that they thought that she was around 8 years old. So they came back in court saying that she was actually a child, that the parents spun this whole story and then just abandoned her so that they can move to Canada with their gifted child.
Oh, shit.
Now, nobody really knows the truth. This is just how it's been spun by the state, but there's also the potential that this really is a scammer who's been kind of moving around as a child for like the last few decades,
right?
Which is a really interesting story when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, wouldn't there be a definite test where you could determine the age of somebody, like undispute
it? I don't know. I hope that they figure it out soon though, and I hope that they do it. If you know of one, let us know, even though it'll have no bearing on the whole case. You know what, let somebody know though.
Yeah,
maybe write into the people in Lafayette, Indiana.
But in the meantime, place your bets. Is she 21 or is she 8 years old?
Yeah.
Whoever wins gets a pizza party.
Hey. Now, the parents, Christine and Michael, were arrested for abandoning a child and have been released since on like a $5,000 bail and bond, which is good for them, I guess. But holy shit, what a case.
What a case. And I hope they didn't abandon their other kid in Canada.
I know, right? Oh my God. Yeah. And kid, if you're listening, don't come here. We don't have room for you.
No.
Yeah. All right. So that is that. Thank you, Casey, for sending that in.
Yeah. I was going to say that literally sounds like a movie, but that is literally a movie.
Yeah.
And now it's playing out in real life.
Yeah. They kind of pointed that in the article. They're just kind of like, this sounds a little bit too good to be true. So it might be.
Right. Yeah.
We shall see.
We shall see, girls.
All right. So do you have any oopsie poopsies this week?
I don't think so.
Neither do I. Although I do want to mention, big apologies to everyone for some little audio blips these last few weeks. I just want to acknowledge it. Not everyone has heard them because they've been caught pretty quickly and taken care of. But we've been making some changes with our editing process and software recently, just trying some things out. And things have gotten a little bit glitchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been nothing huge, but there have just been like at least once per episode that for the last like 3 or 4 episodes where like a phrase will be repeated or something that's been cut out will be in. So yeah, it's just a little bit of an anomaly. So we're just going back to the original way of doing shit. And hopefully this episode won't have any oopsie poopsies in it, but that's yet to be seen.
And you can't predict the future. You're not Raven.
Yeah, I am but a mere mortal. All right, so that is that. Let's just get into this then, girl.
All right.
All right, I'm going first this week.
Yes.
Cute. Well, last week I did a banger, and this week I'm doing one too, because guess what, girl? Mama's doing her first cryptid.
Ooh, 'tis the season.
I know, right? Baby's first cryptid, just in time for Halloween. This week, I am doing the motherfucking Jersey Devil.
Oh, no, she didn't.
Yes, she did. All right, children, settle now. Michelle Visage was born Michelle Lynn Shupak on September 20th of 1968. She is an American singer, television host, radio DJ, performer, television producer, and media personality who is best known for being a member of the band Seduction, as well as appearing as a judge on the American reality television competition RuPaul's Drag Race. JK, I'm going to talk about the other infamous Jersey Devil today.
Right.
Yeah. So this other one, much like Michelle Visage, is a cryptid.
Okay.
And it originates in 1735, which just blows the Michelle Visage theory out the water because this is 10 years after Michelle Visage was born.
Oh, right. Good point.
Exactly. So this all starts in 1735 in Estelleville, New Jersey. The origin story of the Jersey Devil surrounds this woman named Jane Leeds, who's also known by some as Mother Leeds.
Ooh.
What a nickname. But I guess it's kind of accurate because she did have 12 children.
Oh, damn. But I feel like that was probably average for 1700s, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
like, if you're not having 12 kids by the time you're 23.
Yeah, what are you doing with your life?
Uh-huh.
Exactly. Yeah. So Jane had her 12 kids. She had a drunkard husband who was kind of a ne'er-do-well, so he didn't really do anything around the house.
Right.
So she was just kind of, you know, moving and shaking and making shit happen. Just living that Jersey life.
Right.
Now, the thing is, this would have been all well and good, except Jane ends up getting impregnated with a 13th child.
Ooh.
Mm, and she is not too happy about this.
Right.
Now, when this happens, she essentially, according to legend, throws her hands up to the sky and proclaims that this child will be the devil.
Okay.
Correction, all children are the devil, Jane.
Right, it just took her 12 to figure that out.
I know, right? Some of us are in different arcs.
Right.
Yeah, but the thing is, according to legend, she throws her hands up and she says, quote, let this one be a devil,
mm-hmm.
which, if you ask me, is a tradition I wish stuck.
Yeah.
I think that's how we should all proclaim the birth of a child in this day and age.
Right.
Fuck a gender reveal. Give me the mark of the beast any day.
Yes.
Yeah, so basically she does this and then she just goes along her merry way and she's like, we'll see how this goes. And she ends up carrying the fucker to term. In fact, she ends up giving birth to the damn thing.
Okay.
Yeah, so according to legend, again, because we have to go there, it was a dark and stormy night.
Of course.
Very spooky.
Mm-hmm.
And very inconvenient.
Yeah.
Who the fuck wants to give birth on a dark and stormy night, mama?
Right, and it's the 1700s, you got candles and shit.
Exactly. Those candles are gonna go out. You are in a leaky cabin, okay? Mm-hmm. Look, anyway, so Jane's at home. She's surrounded by some midwives, some friends, her husband, who's probably three sheets to the wind, and her 12 little babies.
Right.
And she gives birth to number 13. And supposedly everything's good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's real cute. It's a boy. He's healthy. He's crying. Everyone's just doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the midwives are midwifing. The kids just kind of scope the scene, meet the baby, and are like, cool, mom. Well, we're going to go do some other shit.
Right.
And she's like, yep, see ya. And then the husband's like, well, you and the baby seem good. I guess I'll like see you in a year or something. And he fucks off to somewhere else.
Right.
Leaving Jane, the baby, and the midwives, as well as a few friends in the room. They're all high-fiving, greeting the baby, you know, goo-goo gaga-ing and all that kind of stuff. When all of a sudden, the baby starts to act a little bit funny.
Okay.
So the baby's cries start to morph a little bit. And what was once a cry suddenly starts to become a growl.
Ooh.
Yeah, very Rosemary's Baby.
Very that.
Mm-hmm. And to add to the Rosemary's Baby of it all,
she cut all of her hair off into a cute short bob, which was really unconventional for the time.
Exactly. And her husband didn't accept it at first, but she was like, it's Fidel Sassoon.
Right.
Totally. Actually, I wish. Here's what happens. Basically, the baby starts growling and then they're just kind of like, what the hell, baby? And then all of a sudden it starts like squirming. You know, you can just imagine this in your head. It's like squirming and shifting. And then it just starts growing.
Ooh.
Yeah, just like a regular baby, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, totally. This is what I'm assuming.
I mean, I wish that's how babies work, because then within a couple of days, you'd be sending them off to college and you wouldn't have to worry
exactly.
about it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, no, then maybe I'd consider actually having a fucking kid. Sorry, mom, not sorry. Anyway, here's the thing. This baby starts growing and morphing, and its face starts to like become misshapen, and it changes from the face of a baby almost into the face of like a horse mixed with a goat.
Ooh.
Not cute.
No.
Yeah, and then it sprouted really large leathery wings.
Ooh.
And then supposedly hair and feathers started sprouting out all over its body, and it grew talons out its fingers, and then horns grew out of its head, and it grew this like large forked tail, and its eyes were like beating glowing red.
Shit.
And all of a sudden this thing is like standing up on 2 feet and went from being like a little baby in Jane's arms to being this thing that is now literally standing over her in her hospital bed.
Right. I mean, that's what she gets for drinking all those Red Bulls during her pregnancy, I guess.
I know, right? But that's what we know now. This is back then, you know?
Oh, right. They didn't know any better.
In our history, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the thing is, this baby monster is just like mean mugging Jane in the bed, and then all of a sudden just attacks her.
Oh.
Yeah. And then basically just mangles Jane and rips her limb from limb, being like, thanks for birthing me. Now I'm going to kill you.
Yikes.
Yeah, and people are coming for millennials.
Right. All we did was kill the napkin industry.
Yeah, mom. Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, we're over here with our avocado toast. This thing's turning into a fucking gutter monster. All of a sudden, this thing, after attacking Jane and killing its mother, then turns its attention to the rest of the people in the room and just starts attacking them and flying around the room, whipping them with its tail and clawing at them and biting them.
Right.
And then after this monster feels like it's left its mark on the party, it flies out of the room toward the room where the drunk father and the 12 siblings of this beast just happen to be doing their thing.
Right.
It's a cabin. There's not a lot of room.
No.
Exactly. So the beast breaks down the door, goes into the room, and then basically just starts maiming and killing whoever it can. This goes on for a little while, and then after the bloodbath, it flies out through the chimney, and the people who survived this onslaught just watch it fly out the chimney and toward the New Jersey Pine Barrens.
Right.
Yeah, and then it basically just like disappears into the trees. Now, this is where the story starts. It is said that now this beast lives out in the New Jersey Pine Barrens.
Right.
And it's just kind of roaming around. And if you come in contact with it, girl, that baby monster is going to fuck the living shit out of you. No, not like that.
I get it.
Yeah, no, it's going to like, exactly. That's what I mean. Now it's that is a whole other monster.
Mm-hmm.
That is equally terrifying, though.
Now that reminds me of this movie called The Unnameable. You ever hear of it?
No, but it's about a fuck monster.
Kind of. Yeah. She's just like this like goat like demon thing with like big titties, and she goes around and fucks people.
Oh.
I think Unnameable. Check it out.
Cool. Sounds great. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, after causing all this havoc, the family is just kind of like, okay, well, let's clean up the blood and move on with our lives.
Uh-huh.
I hope that baby never comes back.
Right.
Because, like, who wants to get that fucker a Christmas gift now?
Right? What would you get it?
Yeah.
What if you piss it off?
Exactly. But, like, honey, day one, you are out of the family will.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No inheritance for you.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you can't come back from this. So that's that. Now, this is a lot of song and dance for just a woman cursing a baby in her belly. Like, do I really have to watch my words that closely with my unborn child?
Right.
Yeah. Well, maybe not. There are some other explanations for how this came to be. The rumor has it that maybe Jane Leeds was, you know, in cahoots with the devil.
Ooh.
And maybe they were a little bit more than friends, you know what I mean?
By cahoots, you mean knocking boots.
Exactly. They were fuck buddies. Now, what some people say happened is that Jane got impregnated by the devil himself, had the baby, and then that demon spawn basically just went on to, like, rock the New Jersey Pine Barrens.
Right.
Some other people say that Jane Leeds wasn't actually the one who cursed herself. It was a, get ready for this, traveling gypsy.
Ooh.
Their words, not mine, who supposedly cursed her when she was a young girl, saying that she would give birth to the Antichrist or something like that.
Okay.
I know, right? It's like, okay, we don't have to say this again. Gypsy is a problematic term to describe Romani people, but also, like, nobody's studying you.
No.
You are a boring little white child living in New Jersey.
Right.
Who do you think you are?
You're already cursed. You're in New Jersey.
Exactly. Yeah, get into it. Other people say that Mother Leeds Leeds wasn't actually a woman named Jane Leeds. They actually believed that it was a woman named Miss Shrouds who lived in Leeds Point, which was close to the New Jersey Pine Barrens. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, in a much less violent take on this tale, the baby was just born misshapen and then one day spreaded wings and flew off on its own.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's just like a more like, you know, five and under version of the story that they could tell.
Right. That's the Tales from the Crypt version.
Yeah. The thing is, that kind of complicates the history even more because some people then don't believe that maybe this originated from the Leeds family, but maybe it was just something that happened at Leeds Point. Anyway, there's no real narrative bearing with those facts, but, you know, it's like this is a folk legend. It's going to have other versions, and I just wanted to acknowledge it before we moved forward.
Okay. I mean, it's good to pick up that stone, flip it around, and look at every single side of it.
Look, we may as well. But it should be known that around this time, like when this all happened and kind of started popping up in local legend around the 1700s, this wasn't known as the Jersey Devil just yet. This was known as the Leeds Devil. Now, there are some other versions of the story where, like, a random girl from Leeds Point fell in love with a British soldier and was cast out by the town. Mm-hmm. There's also another version of the story where just, like, a random woman had this baby as payback to the people of Leeds Point who had been mistreating their minister, basically being like, oh, you're gonna fuck with a man of the cloth? Well, we're gonna drop this demon in your town.
I love a vengeance baby.
Exactly. And that is kind of the thing. Like, no matter how you shake down the Jersey Devil, at the end of the day, it really just is a baby on a revenge warpath.
Right. It's on its reputation tour.
Exactly. Now, since the 1700s, people have been seeing this monster throughout the New Jersey Pine Barrens, just kind of throughout southern New Jersey as well, and in Philadelphia, kind of like within the tri-state area. And all of the sightings kind of have the same characteristics. They say that this beast has a goat slash horse head, bat-like wings that are leathery to touch, horns on the head, small kind of raptor-like arms with clawed hands, legs with cloven hooves, and it's bipedal, so it walks on two legs,
right.
And it has a long forked tail. People say that it runs really fast, almost like a kangaroo. People also describe it almost like a wyvern, which is like a dragon-like mythological creature. Mm-hmm. People also say that it flies very quickly, and that when it communicates, it either growls or emits a really high-pitched scream. Yeah, but at the same time, like, this sounds really freaky, but it also kind of sounds like something that a five-year-old drew.
Yeah, it's literally like that game where you, like, are challenged to take multiple animals and mash them into one new animal.
Basically. Yeah. And, like, I know what I'm describing sounds, like, really intimidating and really horrible, but when you look at drawings of the Jersey Devil, they all look kind of derpy.
Yeah.
Like, there's no real way around it. Like, usually cryptids kind of freak me out. Like, I don't like staring at the pictures for too long. Mm-hmm. Because I'm kind of like, ooh, you know, like my imagination goes places. But I could stare at the Jersey Devil all day because it's just kind of like, don't, you know, like it looks like something that one of my nieces or nephews finger painted.
I mean, fair enough. Also, like, I thought the Jersey Devil was able to climb trees and shit, but how's it doing that with like little raptor arms and cloven heels?
I don't know. It could fly up, I guess, and grip.
I guess so.
Who am I to tell the Jersey Devil what it can or cannot do? True. I'm just here to report on the news.
Right.
Now, with how derpy it looks, I also just love imagining that its high-pitched scream is kind of like, it reminds me of that high-pitched scream that you do when you impersonate like a five-year-old girl. Like, Tyler does this thing at home sometimes, like when he's doing something and like drops a fork or just something really trivial, but wants to act like he's completely heartbroken about it. And It cracks me up every time he fucking does it. So the thing is, when I was reading all the stuff about the Jersey Devil, all that I could imagine, like when they were like, it shrieked at us, was this voice that you do, which, will you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That is it. So that's the thing. I imagine this like derpy looking beast like walking, like hobbling up to you on its cloven hooves with its big wings. And then it just stops there, locks its glowing eyes with you, opens its huge mouth and just emits a... Now, regardless of my thoughts and feelings on it, the people of New Jersey were pretty fucking terrified. Rumors started to spread real quick in the mid-1700s that there was a monster fitting this description living in the New Jersey Pine Barrens and terrorizing anybody unlucky enough to encounter it. And it was said that the fear in the community was so bad that they actually sent out a local clergyman to exorcise the demon from the Pine Barrens in 1740.
Shit.
Yeah, but unfortunately, as I've learned through researching this story, story, I guess exorcisms aren't forever. They expire around the 100-year mark.
Really?
Yeah.
So, like, say if you were exorcised when you were, like, 1 year old as a baby.
Yeah.
And then you live to be 102, you could become repossessed?
Exactly.
Whoa.
Yeah, or, like, a little bit off from that, depending on how strong the demon is.
Okay.
As we come to see with the Jersey Devil, because it is said that the Jersey Devil started popping up again around 1812, when people started hearing wailing and screaming coming from the Pine Barrens. And then Joseph Bonaparte, who was Napoleon's older brother, was out near his Bordentown, New Jersey estate hunting, just kind of like in the woods, and said that he encountered the monster and like ran away. You know, he got away with his life. But he came back and he was like, howdy, y'all. I can explain all the wailing in the woods I saw with my very own eyes.
He said in his French ass accent.
Yeah, no, totally French. Très French, in fact. Now, that happens in 1812. In 1840, a string of suspicious livestock deaths start to pop up in the area. So cows, sheep, and chickens especially, start dying left, right, and center, and nobody can really explain what is going on, except that it must be the Leeds Devil.
Or maybe a chupacabra.
But they didn't know the chupacabra yet. It's not the 90s.
You know what? They didn't know a lot of things. Like, they didn't even know all the birds that were flying in the sky.
Oh, that's true. And we will never truly know what's at the bottom of the ocean.
No.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is all well and good. We have a scattered sighting here and there. We're hearing some weird noises. This is kind of what goes on in the 1800s and the early 1900s until 1909 rolls around. Ooh. And we enter full fucking Jersey Devil fever.
Right alongside that industrial boom.
Exactly. Yeah. So basically in January 1909, specifically the week of January 16th through to the 23rd, sightings of the Jersey Devil came in the thousands.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is also when the name Jersey Devil got coined in the media. They stopped calling it the Leeds Devil and they just, you know, expanded it to the Jersey Devil because it was kind of being seen all throughout South Jersey.
Made it more regional.
Exactly. They made it relatable content. So, Devil Mania starts on Monday, January 16th of 1909. Thack Cozens from Woodbury, New Jersey, saw a creature that was fitting the description of the Jersey Devil flying down the street with glowing eyes. This was super early in the morning. Nobody else was around. So Thack is just kind of like, this is weird. Meanwhile, in Bristol, Pennsylvania, John McGowan heard and saw the monster as well and then saw it flying away. While at the same time in Bristol, Pennsylvania, E.W. Minister, who was the town's postmaster, saw a creature that he had described as being bird-like with a horse's head that emitted a high-pitched scream, which fits the description of the Jersey Devil.
Sure does.
So, we have these three sightings all early in the morning on January 16th. These people all independently report what they have seen once people wake up. But, unrelated to all of that, later in the morning on January 16th, the community wakes up. And all of a sudden, people notice that there are really strange tracks going through the snow throughout Bristol, Pennsylvania, Burlington, New Jersey, as well as Columbus, Hedden, Kinhora, and Rakocas. Basically, people saw these kind of like 2-foot hoof prints going throughout the snow that belong to the Jersey Devil.
Right, and the fact that they looked 2-footed is weird because I don't think there's any animal in the world that we know of that has hooves and walks on 2 feet.
Exactly. Basically, people see these tracks. That's weird enough, but not aided by the fact that they are not only going through backyards, but they are also going underneath fences, like where there's like only 8 inches of space, as well as over rooftops.
Oh.
Yeah, and then more reports came out of Camden, New Jersey of these footprints and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So everyone was just real freaked out. Now, police in Hamilton basically tried to release bloodhounds to track the prints, but the bloodhounds refused to follow the track. They did not want to go anywhere near it and basically just cowered in fear.
Oh, that's very bizarre.
Yeah, so basically Monday, January 16th, all this shit randomly occurs and people don't know what to do. Tuesday, the 17th, two hunters encounter the devil just outside Gloucester and basically tail it for about 20 minutes. They just like come upon it in the woods. They keep a safe distance. They don't get, you know, noticed by the Jersey Devil and they follow it for 20 miles.
Shit.
But ultimately it evades them. That day, a local paper, the Asbury Park Press, also runs a headline that says, "What mysterious tracks are these?" And then is followed by an article that outlines all of these witness reports that have been popping up from the previous day. Now, this basically starts an onslaught lot of sightings. Local papers over the next few days, like until the 23rd really, just start putting out hundreds into the thousands of reports from local people who had supposedly seen the Jersey Devil.
Damn.
Sightings were reaching out as far as Maryland and Delaware. Basically, people were seeing tracks, they were running into it in the woods, and every time it was flying away and not getting too close. Because of this, though, people did not want to leave their homes. Children were not going to school, like attendance levels were dwindling. People were staying home from work to the point that mills in the Pine Barrens area were forced to shut down temporarily. And people began roaming the countryside, weapons in hands, trying to encounter the Jersey Devil, like in posses.
Damn.
Yeah, and then basically when people were at home, they weren't even safe because they were seeing the Jersey Devil, like shadowy figures that looked like it walking by their window and stuff like that. Like basically people just felt like they were being stalked no matter where they went. On top of that, now, by Thursday, January 19th, 1909, a Mr. and Mrs. Evans from Gloucester were woken up at 2:30 in the morning by the Jersey Devil in what would actually be considered the longest sighting of the Jersey Devil to date. They described it to a local paper as, quote, about 3.5 feet high, with a head like a collie dog and a face like a horse. It had a long neck, wings about 2 feet, and its back legs were like those of a crane, and it had horse's hooves. It walked on its back legs and held up two short front legs with paws on them. It didn't use the front legs at all while we were watching. My wife and I were scared, I tell you, but I managed to open the window and say, shoo, and it turned around and barked at me and then flew away.
Whoa.
Yeah, but you know what, Mr. Evans, use your words. That's right.
Yeah.
Don't hurt an animal.
Exactly.
Exactly. Now, that's 2:30 a.m. on Thursday. Later on that day, the Jersey Devil reportedly attacked a trolley car in Haddon Heights. Mm-hmm. And then, later on, riders on a trolley car in Burlington, New Jersey, saw the Jersey Devil run across the tracks in front of their car. Then, later on Thursday, the Jersey Devil then swooped down upon and attacked a meeting of the Blackhawk Social Club in Camden. Just tried to, like, fuck with them. Didn't really hurt anyone, but then just, like, flew away screaming.
Right.
And the sightings basically just continued. Police in Camden, Bristol, and Pennsylvania all reportedly saw the Jersey Devil and then fired at it, all to no avail. This thing was impenetrable. Then, a woman named Miss Sorbinski on Thursday also encountered the Jersey Devil, and when she encountered the fucking thing, it was in her yard trying to eat her dog.
Oh, puppy.
What did that dog do to you?
Right?
The thing is, though, the dog was okay, thankfully. It turns out Miss Sorbinski found the one thing that can take the Jersey Devil down, so please take notes because your bullets don't work here. She brought out a broomstick and started whipping it at the Jersey Devil, and that plus the fury incited by her love for her doggy scared that Jersey Devil back into hell.
It was a broomstick, huh?
Yeah, Miss Sorbinski. Eat it, please. Then, supposedly after this happened, two police officers arrived at Miss Sorbinski's house along with a mob of 100 other people. They're just like, where is this devil? We want to fight it, please and thank you. She's like, I don't know. I put the boots to it. And then this mob of people just hear screaming coming from over Kagan Hill. So they basically just like descend upon it Braveheart style and go try to chase the devil out of town. And supposedly they did for a while until the next day. Friday, the 20th of January, 1909, the devil was caught drinking from a horse's trough in Camden, New Jersey by Louis Straher, who was a police officer.
Okay.
And that is just unruly.
Uh-huh.
Who knows about the flora and fauna of that devil beast's mouth?
Good point.
You don't want to give the horses some sort of devil infection. That's not cute.
No.
Think about the horses. Now, it was also said that during this week, a Navy commander named Stephen Decatur was testing cannonball firing in the area when the Jersey Devil happened to appear. Maybe he was like, hey, I hear that bass. Want a party?
Right.
Now, the Jersey Devil appears on the cannonball firing range, and Stephen Decatur is basically like, score. He shoots a cannon at the Jersey Devil, and unfortunately, it was not a broomstick, so it did nothing. Therefore, solidifying how fucking terrifying this thing was.
Yeah.
Now, we have a community gripped in fear. We have a cryptozoological nightmare running throughout the woods.
Right.
And as we come to learn on this podcast, whenever a big group of people are scared, you can bet your bottom dollar that there is going to be somebody just listening and waiting to come take their money and pry on their fear.
Oh, yes, honey.
Yes. So enter the hucksters. Basically, after this initial week week of Jersey Devil Mania, local freak show operators were clamoring to find out how to present a Jersey Devil to everyone and be the person with the first one in captivity.
Right.
So, get this. A local oddity museum ends up advertising that they have the only Jersey Devil in captivity.
Of course.
People flock to come see it. And guess what they put up there and tried to parade around as the Jersey Devil?
Oh my god, like a goat with like party wings?
Close. A kangaroo with wings harnessed on its back. Some people also say it was glued. I don't like to think that though. Yeah, but you know what?
No,
it
wouldn't surprise me.
People are fucking horrible. So it didn't really take long for that to get found out. Those people were made a laughing stock of. That was kind of the final nail in the coffin for the Jersey Devil's popularity at the time.
Right.
This was around the 19-teens, I guess. Whatever.
Yeah.
The thing is, basically, to be blunt, basically, it wasn't cool anymore and people didn't want to seem stupid and gullible. So people just stopped talking about the Jersey Devil. They were just kind of like, remember that stupid boogeyman kind of thing that we believed in a few years ago?
Right. And I mean, plus World War One was happening at this time. So people's priorities were maybe shifting.
Exactly. They had bigger fish to fry at the time. But that didn't stop the Jersey Devil from kind of rearing its head every now and then and people having sightings. Now, I'm going to breeze through a few right now. We're going to kind of hop through decades because they're really all kind of the same. People see footprints, they hear screaming, they see this beast when they're going through the woods or on the side of the road. It usually comes to them, maybe fucks with them a little bit, and then flies off by the end of it, screeching and, you know, going. Exactly. So I'm going to breeze through a few. You're going to kind of get the flavor for what this beast supposedly does. But ultimately, if I were to drag you down with every single little detail of these stories, we'd be here for 4 fucking hours.
Forever.
Exactly. So, 1925, a farmer in Greenwich, New Jersey, shoots an unidentifiable creature that he believes to be the Jersey Devil. The thing is, no one really cared.
Right.
It was out of style at the time. Everyone was like, oh, you're some gullible old farmer. And according to legend, every time that this beast was supposedly killed by somebody, it never really hung around and usually reanimated and then was back out there in the woods. So good luck holding that devil down.
Nothing gonna break its stride.
Exactly. Now, 1927, a cab driver on his way to Salem ends up getting a flat tire. He pulls over on the side of the road to fix it, gets out of his car, doing his thing. All of a sudden, he notices the Jersey Devil off in the distance. It comes to him and basically is like encroaching upon him as if it wants to attack him.
Right.
This cab driver gets back in his car. The Jersey Devil hops on top of his car and then just starts shaking the whole thing.
Ugh.
And rocking it back and forth. And then basically the cab driver is able to get his shit together, starts the car and speeds off.
Right.
The Jersey Devil flies away. Now, there are a bunch more interactions with the Jersey Devil, a bunch of stories like that, or people hiking through the woods and then running into it and it flying away. In 1936, there was some press about people hearing the Jersey Devil supposedly out in the woods near Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
In 1951, a group of boys reported in Gibson, New Jersey, that they saw the Jersey Devil while out playing in the forest. 1953, a guy named Philip Scott reports seeing the devil while walking down the street, and then it just like flies away. And then in 1957, the Department of Conservation ends up finding an odd corpse in a burnt out area in the Pine Barrens.
Uh-huh.
It was a partial skeleton. It had feathers and oddly shaped hind legs. Now, they could not figure out what the fuck this thing was.
Right.
So after some time, some people are like, maybe this is the Jersey Devil. And maybe it's dead.
Right.
So they just kind of dispose the animal's corpse, they burn it, whatever, they do their thing, and they're just like, well, I guess it died of natural causes, but honey, the Jersey Devil kept being seen throughout the end of the 50s.
Uh-huh.
To the point that in 1960, a $250,000 reward was offered from different business people in Camden, New Jersey, to anybody who could capture the Jersey Devil. Basically, they said that if you caught it, they'd put it in a private zoo, and guess what, Mama? The prize was never claimed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And around this time in 1960, the residents of Mary's Landing started to hear screeching in the woods at night and got so freaked out that the police actually had to go around and put up flyers in the community to be like, hey, everyone, the Jersey Devil isn't real. You don't have to be scared.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but to them, it's the realness. Now, 1961, two couples that were parked in the same car on Lover's Lane, which, I mean, get yours.
Get yours, Annie.
They're out doing their lover's lane thing near the Pine Barrens, thinking that they're completely alone. Problem is, they start to hear screeching outside the car. Then the roof of the car starts getting smashed. They flee the scene, only to return later like dumb shit.
Yeah.
And they supposedly see the Jersey Devil flying among the trees, screeching. And they're just like, well, that's all the evidence we need. And they get out of there.
Uh-huh.
Now, these kind of interactions continue on. We go into the 70s. It's happening, but everyone's on acid. And then we get into the 80s. 1980, a report came in from the Wharton State Forest Chief Ranger, Alan McFarlane, that he had investigated a really brutal slaying of a whole bunch of animals near a South Jersey pig farm. Basically, he said that he found the backs of pigs' heads randomly eaten, and then the carcasses all had scratches and like really kind of like otherworldly markings on them.
Right.
But he also then found no blood on the ground or tracks coming from in or out of the woods near the pig farm.
Which means something would swoop down out of the sky.
Exactly.
Nom nom and then swoop away.
And drain the blood before it left.
Right.
But no sighting of the devil. 1981, a couple spots the Jersey Devil out near Atsian Lake in Atlantic City. In 1993, a forest ranger named John Irwin encountered the devil while driving along the Mullica River. Supposedly, the devil had been blocking the road and then just stopped and stared at him for a few minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then just turned away and ran into the woods. Like, didn't fly, it ran.
Right.
It was leg day, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there was the one that I find the most freaky because there's actually a photo.
Okay.
So, October 2015, a guy named David Black from Little Egg Harbor is driving through the Galloway Township on Route 9 near a golf course. And he saw what he thought was a llama walking along the tree line.
Okay.
And I guess was just like, cool, it's a llama, whatever. It must be common in New Jersey. But then, all of a sudden, this random llama just opens wings and flies away. So, at this point, David took a picture. Do you want to see it?
I do.
Here you go.
Bitch, that looks like some bullshit from My Little Pony. That's not scary.
No, we'll post it on Instagram, don't worry. But you know what? It is a little bit freaky. When I first saw it, I was like, ooh, I don't know about that. But then I turned up the brightness of my phone and
right.
It was okay. Yeah. So around that same time, though, at Old Port Republic Road, a woman named Emily Martin also shot a video of a very similar creature flying across the night sky, just how David Black had described it.
Right.
And I happen to have a copy of that video. Do you want to see that?
I do.
Well, bitch, here's the corroborating evidence.
Not convinced.
It looks like a sky dancer.
It does. It looks like if you took Fleetwood, our wiener dog, threw some wings on it and tossed them up in the air.
No, totally. It looks like the thing was just kind of sitting out of frame for a few seconds and then was like, oh, am I supposed to go? Okay. Ooh,
yeah.
And then gets out.
Yeah.
It's so frantic and funny. I love it. Anyway, whatever. It was terrifying.
Terrifying. We'll post it on Instagram.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So that is to say the sightings of the Jersey Devil continue to this day. But the question remains, is it real?
Right.
We don't really know. The thing is, a medical sociologist named Robert E. Bartholomew, in regard to the 1909 like mass sightings, basically just describes it as a case of mass hysteria. He said that, you know, the urban legends kind of fueled it all, and people probably saw some unidentifiable creatures out in the woods, like some animals that they had just never seen before.
Right.
And this kind of sparked all of the rumors and, you know, kind of threw everyone into a tizzy.
Right. And I would say I would agree with that because it seemed like the 1910 sort of situation was when there were many documentations of it. After that, it seemed like it was like, oh, one here, one there, one there, one there, but not this like constant like continuous sighting over and over and over again in a short period of time.
Totally. But then the question remains, how did the original story kind of come out then? Like, there had to be something that kind of inspired this story that then sparked the 1909 mass hysteria.
Right.
That is where Ben Franklin becomes involved in things.
Say what?
Buckle up. So, according to some scholars, particularly a guy named Brian Regal, who wrote a great article for Skeptical Inquirer called The Jersey Devil, The Real Story, points out a political rivalry that happened back in the 18th century between Benjamin Franklin and a guy named Daniel Leeds. So basically, Daniel Leeds, from what I understand, was a really prominent Quaker in his community. community, which was near the Pine Barrens in New Jersey.
Right.
And basically, he had landed there in 1677, became a total hotshot. This was all well and good until he ended up becoming ostracized over time for publishing almanacs that had, like, astrological symbols and writings about the stars and their relationship to Christianity.
Yeah, and that's not Christian.
Well, exactly. Basically, they deemed it too pagan, and ultimately, he was censored. The almanacs were destroyed, but Daniel Leeds kind of thumbed his nose at the whole thing and continued to publish them, which ultimately solidified his reputation as being a Christian occultist.
Right.
Now, the thing is, Daniel Leeds did this throughout the rest of his life, and then his son, Titan Leeds, ended up taking over the publishing after Daniel was too old to do it anymore. And when Titan took on the publishing of the almanacs with all of these, like, ooky spooky symbols in it, he published them with the Leeds family crest on the cover, which was a dragon-like creature, kind of like a wyvern or kind of like a Jersey devil. Yeah. So here's where Ben Franklin comes into it, because supposedly Ben Franklin at the time was writing almanacs as well and saw Daniel Leeds and Titan Leeds in this whole, you know, little witchy book that they had as his most fiercest competition.
Right.
So basically it is believed that Ben Franklin and his little cronies just started up, you know, through the rumor mill, all this hateful gossip about the Leeds family, calling them Satanists and saying that all the astrological stuff that they were saying, you know, linked them to the devil. You know, coming from the perspective of being a learned man, he was like, oh no, it's not Christian.
Right.
He's literally God warrior. But basically, he reportedly started calling Daniel the Leeds devil or something to that effect.
Right.
And people believe that maybe because of that and all the kind of spooky ooky stories that surrounded this guy who had been cast out of his community, plus the dragon on the cover of his almanacs, all kind of got amalgamated together and turned into this early Jersey Devil story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really murky, but it's really just kind of like they threw a book cover, a reputation, and a nickname into a pot and then mixed it up.
Right.
And then this urban legend kind of sprung out of it.
Right. And I mean, Benjamin Franklin, obviously somebody of notoriety, somebody who people would have, like, trusted and respected and maybe even wanted to impress.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, no, they would have kept the bullshit going.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Ben Franklin also started rumors that Titan Leeds, like the son of Daniel, who had died in 1732, was haunting him and, like, spilling tea to him and all this kind of stuff. So even after these people were dead and gone, he was still like, oh no, they are not Christian.
Couldn't let it go.
Exactly. No, he had a chip on his shoulder. So people believe that maybe this is just kind of where it all started.
Damn.
And then in 1909, this kind of like local urban myth just kind of mixed with some weird animal sightings and started up this Jersey Devil folklore that we know today. Because all the details are really murky. I mean, this is a cryptid story. Like, we're not dealing with a lot of cold hard facts here, you know what
right.
I mean? But it's pretty spooky. I will say some people have really tried to kind of suss out the whole situation. It was discovered through local records that there was a woman named Deborah Leeds that people do maybe believe was this Mother Leeds in the community. She was married to a man named Japhet Leeds. Basically, we know this because in Japhet's will, he not only mentions his wife Deborah, but his 12 children as
right.
well. He died in 1736, just about a year after this whole Jersey Devil story originated. And to top things off, they also lived out in Leeds Point, New Jersey.
Right.
But ultimately, there is no record that they ever had a demon baby or anything like that. That is just us in the new millennium trying to look back through old records and go, well, maybe this is the person that we've been talking about in this story that's been developed through a game of broken telephone throughout the decades.
Right. And I mean, that's all history really is. We're just looking at, like, past clues and trying to put it all together and be like, well, I guess this connects to this or this connects to that. So, you know, if you get a couple good old Quakers in the 1700s playing Nancy Drew, they can come up with all kinds of theories.
That's the thing, right? Now, this leads me to say there have been sightings, there have been hoof prints found that we can't explain all this stuff, but outside of these kind of blurry cell phone photos that have just recently popped up, historically, no photographic evidence of the Jersey Devil exists, and no other real physical evidence supporting the Jersey devil exists.
Right.
The whole thing, intellectually speaking, could be attributed to the local disdain for the Leeds family, plus just kind of the negative view of people who lived in the Pine Barrens at the time, just trying to make them seem, you know, ungodly and unrefined and all this kind of stuff, on top of just like the sheer sexiness of this spooky ass story. Basically, people just think that this all led to mass hysteria and sightings of this monster. And the legend lives on today because, as a guy named Bill Sprouse, who was a descendant of the Leeds family, said in an interview with Vice, he believes it lives on because it points back to a much wilder, more mystical time. The area is pretty suburban now, although a large part of the Pine Barrens is still untouched. But by and large, the surrounding area is a lot more suburban. And basically, the story of the Jersey Devil kind of adds a little bit of magic to all the strip malls and casinos and, you know, the industrialization in the area. Plus, these Pine Barrens are pretty spooky-ooky as they are because they are so untouched. They are a common spot for people to dump murder victims and things like that. Like, it has a very spooky vibe around it.
Right.
So it doesn't take much to think that maybe there's something otherworldly or haunting kind of roaming throughout the woods.
Right. And I mean, as this podcast is a testament to, we as human beings just love a good story.
Yeah.
And there's probably not that many people out there that really want to fully debunk it. There is a part of us that probably wants to believe and think, oh, what if the Jersey Devil is out there eating cows and shit?
And that's exactly the thing, because regardless of whether or not it's true, regardless of historical fact, blah, blah, fucking blah, this is a fun old spooky story. Mm-hmm. It is a good old legend that has a lot of people too freaked out to go in the woods. And mama, we had fun.
We did.
Yeah.
And I learned some new things. Like, yeah. Benjamin Franklin's a dick.
I know. He's a real douche.
I mean, he probably was already a douche anyway. It's the 1700s, yeah, exactly. And he was a political leader. But hey, affirmation.
Exactly. Now, many thanks to my sources, weirdnj.com, allthat'sinteresting.com, ancientorigins.net, the article Why the Urban Legend of the Jersey Devil Won't Die by Peter Moskowitz on vice.com, rationalwiki.org, the article The Jersey Devil, The Real Story by Brian Regal for Skeptical Inquirer, theshadowlands.net, and nj.com's 13 times the Jersey Devil has been spotted in the Garden State by Kelly Ron Case.
Well, wow, Johnny, thanks for bringing that to the table. Your first cryptid, and what a bangalanga.
Thank you. It's a real murky story to tell, those cryptids, you know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
Not a lot of cold, hard facts to string together a real logical timeline, but I tried.
I mean, that's all you can do. They're cryptids. They're mysterious.
Thanks. All right, that is all I have. Now it's your turn.
All right. So your story was iconic.
Trey iconic.
And if I do say so myself, my story this week is also iconic.
Ooh, well, I will be the judge of that.
All right.
As the iconic, please.
Okay. Well, this week I'm going to be talking about the Pontefract Poltergeist.
Ooh, Trey iconic.
Uh-huh. It's notably one of the most violent and aggressive poltergeists ever documented.
Mm-hmm.
A bit of context before we really get into it as well. This happened in the 1960s. So if you think about it in context to other hauntings and other poltergeist stories, this happened before the Enfield Poltergeist, and this happened before Amityville Horror, long before anybody really thought to make bank off of a haunting story.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The OG.
The OG. So it's 1966 and we're with the Pritchard family. They've just moved into their new home at 30 East Drive in Pontefract, West Yorkshire, England. So the Pritchard family consisted of Jean and Joe Pritchard and their two children, 15-year-old Philip and 12-year-old Diane. Now, the house had not had a notable history. It was thought to be just any other house, though the Pritchard family would soon learn that that was not the case.
She was different than the other girls.
She was much different than the other girls. So the first incident of paranormal activity happened on September 1st, 1966. The oldest son, Philip, was staying at home alone with his grandmother, Sarah Scholes. The rest of the family was on a trip to Devon. They were celebrating Labor Day weekend, but Philip, being the older child, wanted to stay back. Jean and Joe were okay with this, so long as the grandmother agreed to stay with him over the weekend.
Grandma party.
Now, it's September 1st, so it was late summer, and this particular day was warm and sunny. But at one point, both Philip and Sarah were sitting in the room downstairs when they felt a cold breeze blow through the home.
Okay.
It can really only be described as an inexplicable chill. As the two exchanged looks of confusion, a white mist, almost like flakes of snow, started to fall from the ceiling as footsteps began to thump from above.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently the house had been renovated, so they thought that maybe this was some kind of like dust from drywall or sanding or something like that. But the fact that it just continued to fall steadily really confused them. So after a while, they decided to go across the street and call for Marie Kelly. Now, Marie Kelly was actually Sarah's daughter, so Philip's aunt. She came over to the house and noticed that the white substance was still falling and there was still thumping coming from upstairs.
Okay.
They were all really confused. The only thing they could think to do was maybe try and clean up some of the mess that had fallen onto the floor. So Marie went into the kitchen. When she went into the kitchen, she suddenly slipped. And when she looked around, she noticed that there were random puddles of water all over the floor of the kitchen.
Oh, so I guess they didn't do a great job with the renovation.
I guess not. And maybe they thought that as well. They called an emergency plumbing service who came over right away. The person checked the pipes, checked the plumbing, checked everything. But there was no indication as to what was causing these puddles of water to form. Basically, there were no leaks in the house.
They're like, maybe you just got some fat raccoons.
Right, exactly. Or they basically chalked it up to some kind of weird condensation.
Oh, okay.
Not really a rational explanation, but they took it. It was at least some sort of an explanation.
Yeah.
So they went about cleaning up the floors. They cleaned up the weird powdery substance that had fallen earlier, and they mopped up all the puddles. And after that, they just kind of tried to carry on with their day like normal. Marie stayed and visited for a while, but eventually she decided to go home. Philip and Sarah decided to wind down for the night.
Mm-hmm.
That really didn't happen, though, because at one point, Philip goes into the kitchen and sees that the puddles have re-emerged.
Oh.
He calls for Sarah. Sarah comes into the kitchen. They kind of walk around, and then they see that there's a mess on the counter. There's, like, sugar everywhere and tea leaves everywhere, and that's when they notice that the tea dispenser on the counter was going on and off on its own. So there was, like, this little button that you would press to release the tea,
mm-hmm.
and the button was just being pressed, and tea was falling out. It was being pressed, and tea was falling out. And this happened until the dispenser was completely empty. And even after it was empty, the button still kept going in and out, in and out.
Oh my God, that shady poltergeist spilling the tea until there was no more tea to spill.
It spilled the tea until there was no more tea to spill, and it put a little sugar on it as well.
Yes, Daddy.
Yeah. So Philip and Sarah totally freaked out. The water's back, tea is spilled everywhere, and then they notice in the hallway that comes off of the kitchen and leads to the stairwell that the light in the hallway is going on and off, on and off, mm-hmm. on and off, on and off.
Go home. Mm-hmm.
They get freaked out, but again, they try to rationalize everything. Oh, maybe it's weird wiring as well. Maybe it's caused because of the water damage. Who knows what's going on with this clinky clacky house, but what we gotta do is we just gotta clean this mess up and go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what they do.
Really?
Yeah. That is until Sarah goes up to Philip's room as Philip is getting ready for bed, and then they both notice that his dresser in the corner of the room starts shaking and rattling all on its own.
Oh no.
That was the last straw for Sarah and Philip, and they decided to pack an overnight bag, and then they just scooted it out of the house to stay with Marie across the street for the rest of the night.
I don't blame them.
Not at all.
Like, you can spill all the tea you want, but do not fuck with my furniture.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a couple of days later, the rest of the Pritchard family returned. Jean, Joe, and Diane. They had a great weekend. They talked to Sarah and Philip, and Sarah and Philip informed them on what they had experienced, and everybody was kind of on edge. They were like, this sounds really weird. What is going on? The thing is, nothing else happened. No more pools of water appeared. No more tea was spilt. The lights stayed on when they were put on, then they stayed off when they were turned off, and no furniture was shaking.
Whoa, ghost, way to gaslight the two of them.
Exactly. And they really were gaslit, because there wouldn't be another incident for another 2 years.
Ooh, so everyone's just like, oh yeah, remember the time that Philip and Grandma went crazy that weekend?
Exactly. Yeah, and it was so far in the past that after 2 years, everybody kind of forgot about it. Everybody was just carrying on with their lives. Philip was about 17, 18 at this point, and Diane was about 14 or 15 at this point. But in 1968, the activity would ramp up again. All of a sudden, pools of water began to form in the kitchen, just like before. Furniture began to shake. Green foam would ooze out of the taps in the home, and bangs and scratches could be heard all throughout the house. The doors would slam by themselves, and family portraits would even be found with knife slashes through them.
Oh, now that's just rude.
Uh-huh. It's like, this is 1968. They don't have hard copies of these photos. They're one of a kind. They can't scan them. They are not digital. They can't go to a Kodak machine and print them off again.
Exactly. Like, they're lucky if they still have that negative kicking around.
Uh-huh.
Girl, what a thoughtless, destructive poltergeist.
Absolutely. That's really the problem with poltergeists.
Yeah, like I said, don't fuck with my decor.
Uh-huh.
Everything has a place, and it is not up to you, Mr. or Mrs. Poltergeist, to fuck with that.
Exactly.
You are a guest in my home.
And you're going to abide by my rules.
Yeah, you can haunt me, just don't move my tchotchkes.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if you'd fare off so well with a poltergeist. I feel like you two would clash.
No, we would just need to establish boundaries. It's like the Big Brother household.
Right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Now, all of this physical activity was happening, but the poltergeist was also a bit of a smelly bitch, because people would be walking around the house, and then all of a sudden they'd be like, oh, yeah, smells like ass.
They do that. Yeah, they smell like sulfur. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
literally. Not only that, though, the family was also plagued by an assortment of strange sounds.
Uh-huh.
They would hear things like barnyard animals. They'd hear like cows and pigs just throughout their home. They would also hear breathing and sometimes even feel breath in and around their ears.
Ooh, that's weird.
Yeah, weird for sure, but these things became pretty commonplace. Although there would be moments of calm, the activity would inevitably ramp up after a couple of weeks of maybe laying low.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no more two-year hiatuses at this point.
No, it's just all day, every day.
It's all day, every day. But because it's all day, every day, the family got used to it pretty quick. They just got used to things kind of being out of place, things being slashed up with knives, and hearing horses in their house.
Oh, wow, yeah.
They even got to the point where they started to refer to the entity as Fred. They were like, oh, there's Fred again, mooing like a cow.
Oh, that Fred.
That Fred.
What a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm. Now, what makes this particular haunting all the more interesting is that these experiences weren't just left to the family in the home. Pretty much anybody who came into the home was guaranteed to experience something. Like, this poltergeist really liked to fuck with the visitors of the house.
Okay.
So very often, if people came over to the home, they would see items move and levitate across the room. They would see furniture shake. They would hear these barnyard animals, all of the same things that the family were experiencing.
A poltergeist is just like an annoying child. Like, company comes over and suddenly it's in the middle of the room being like, look what I can do. Look what I can do.
Yeah, totally.
I can do an impression of a cow. Now I can dance. I learned how to do a handstand, but I can't really do it. Can you hold me up? Bye. I like your shoes.
Yeah, it's very that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very that. But the problem with the guests is they would often get physically assaulted by Fred.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, Fred was just fucking with the family, but was attacking their guests. So police officers, priests, vicars all experienced this kind of activity in the home. At one point, a priest was actually threatened with a candlestick that just floated into the air and was positioned directly in front of his face.
Oh.
Another guest had an entire jug of milk poured over their head after they were talking about and mocking Fred.
Well, that's just comical.
Right?
Yeah. Like, 1 point for Fred there.
1 point for Fred. But like all poltergeist hauntings, or at least most poltergeist hauntings, things just didn't stop there. Things just continued to escalate. And as things escalated, the daughter Diane became the subject of interest for Fred. Diane often woke to the sound of heavy breathing in her room, voices in her ears, and beyond that, Diane would experience more physical assaults than anybody else. She experienced being pushed and slapped. She had her hair pulled, and she even had been drugged across the floor on several occasions. The family could deal with the puddles, the smells, the flying objects, but the physical assault on their daughter had them concerned, and so they reached out to the church for help. The Pritchard family home underwent several exorcisms. The unfortunate thing is none of them seemed to work.
Oh.
In fact, they just seemed to piss Fred off more.
Oh, and Fred's already hair pulling. He's fighting dirty already, so this must just escalate shit.
Exactly.
Does he start kicking between the down there?
He very well might. Mm-hmm. During and after these attempted exorcisms, crucifixes and any other religious objects were destroyed by Fred. Furthermore, Fred would paint inverted crosses all over the walls in black and red paint. And there was no black or red paint in the home.
Oh, the Hildy Santo Tomas of it all.
Uh-huh. It Ooh. Literally just manifested out of nowhere.
What a makeover.
For sure. Now, during one of the exorcisms, they started to sing a hymn. While they were singing a hymn, a pair of hands floated through the air. They were wearing, actually, a pair of fuzzy lady dinner gloves.
Okay.
And then they began to conduct in the air along with the hymn. What? Basically, this was just Fred being like, fuck you guys. And also, look at my keen fashion sense.
Yeah, he's like, has anybody seen Fantasia? Anybody get the reference?
Exactly.
Yeah, my fuck you, Fred.
Uh-huh.
My God, you have a flair for the dramatic.
He really does. So, all of these exorcisms failed, and once they were done, the entity in the home began to manifest itself in a physical form for the first time.
Okay.
So up to this point, they were hearing things, seeing things move, but they never experienced any physical form of the entity, which they refer to as Fred. But it began to appear in the family's bedrooms at night, starting with Jane and Joe.
What was she like?
So basically, she was exactly as you would imagine. It was this dark, cloaked figure. It would stand in the corners of rooms or at the foots of their beds. Sometimes it would be floating in the air above their beds.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they described it as this black cloaked figure. They said it actually looked like a medieval monk, which led them to re-nickname Fred the Black Monk. So this black monk started to appear in their bedrooms at night. It would either be standing in the corner or it would be standing in front of their bed. Sometimes it would even be floating in the air above their beds while they slept.
Ooh.
Yeah, you could say she was a bit of a looky-loo. But speaking of looky-loos, a lot of the neighbors in town started to pay a lot of attention to the Pritchards' home as words of the activity continued to spread. And some locals reported actually seeing the entity of the black monk in and around the property.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just exclusive to inside, it was also lurking in the grounds outside, and people were just seeing it at random. And as the sightings became more frequent, the violence against the family became even more extreme. Probably one of the most terrifying encounters you could ever imagine happened to Diane. So she was beginning to wake up with scratches and bruises all over her body. She would wake up sometimes having been thrown from her bed, and she would often be choked and slapped even in front of witnesses. Like, she could just be standing there having a conversation when all of a sudden she would just start to get choked or slapped.
Oh my God.
This thing had no boundaries. But of course, it got even worse. The most extreme attack on Diane occurred when she was downstairs with her family. She was just sitting there when all of a sudden the people around her could see her hair float up into the air, kind of in a bunch, like somebody was grabbing it.
Mm-hmm.
She was then thrown down on the floor, and she started getting pulled and knocked down the hallway.
Oh my God.
She got pulled through the hallway from the living room, through through the kitchen, through the other hallway, and all the way up the stairs.
What a shitty hair-pulling poltergeist.
Very that. Her family chased after her and found her lying on the floor upstairs, just completely freaked the fuck out. And this was when the family was like, what the hell are we going to do? We've tried doing exorcisms. They didn't work. We've tried just ignoring it. That doesn't work. And this thing just seems to be getting more aggressive and more aggressive and more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So because the church didn't work, the family decided to turn to paranormal investigators, and they hoped that this would be able to provide them with an explanation as to what was going on. So basically, they started to invite any and all paranormal investigators, and one particular investigator, Tom Cuniff, unearthed a history related to the family's home. So the property in which the house was built on was once a gallows in the 16th century.
Oh.
On the gallows, there was a monk that had been sentenced to death after raping and killing a young woman in town. So Cuniff basically believed that this entity was the spirit of this monk haunting their home, or was at least a demon taking on the appearance of this monk that had died on their property.
Wow, that's exactly the kind of person that I don't want to stick around in the afterlife.
Exactly, and the Pritchard family felt that same way, but after they gained this information and they began to get more clues as to who or what this poltergeist was, all of a sudden everything just stopped.
Really?
Just completely stopped. The noises were gone. Objects stayed where they were. Diane didn't experience anything. Nobody in the family ever saw the black monk ever again. They lived in the home for another couple of years.
Really?
And just nothing. It was almost like it just got bored and moved on.
It was like, well, you got me, gal.
Exactly.
Girl.
So some believe that although the black monk stopped terrorizing the Pritchard family, it never really left the property. Some people felt that maybe it just went dormant for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Like disco.
Exactly. Yeah. It's never truly dead.
No, it will never die.
Now, the Pritchard family moved out, but nobody ever moved back in because it remained in their family. It was still owned by the Pritchard family. But ever since the 1960s, a lot of paranormal investigations went on in the home. The property was owned by Philip until it was sold to a movie producer, Bill Bungay, in 2012. Now, Bill Bungay at the time was producing a movie loosely based on the Pontefract poltergeist hauntings.
Okay.
And he thought it would be really cool to buy the house, maybe have a premiere there, maybe do this, maybe do that, none of which ever really came to fruition. But after he bought it, the home really started to pop up on a lot of paranormal television programs.
Wow, what privilege. Like, I'm over here having panic attacks about my student loan, and this guy's over here just buying houses on a whim.
Right.
Just for kicks.
Just for kicks. It's very Zach Baggins of him. The only thing he didn't do was knock it down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's step two.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, again, after 2012, it started to appear on a lot of television programs. The home appeared on Ghost Dimensions, Most Haunted, and Paranormal Lockdown, and all have displayed some pretty incredible activity during their investigations. Doors would slam, objects would fly down the stairs, and many EVPs had been recorded. Most of the activity did seem to center around the stairwell.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see why. It's probably one of the most kind of off-putting areas of the house. It's basically in its own little corridor off of the kitchen, so you have to walk down a small, narrow hallway and then turn, and then immediately you're at the foot of the stairs.
Oh, yeah, that would be kind of freaky.
Furthermore, there is also a mirror at the far end wall, so when you're standing in the hallway, you can kind of see up the stairs.
Oh.
So lots of rooms for maybe your eyes to play tricks on you.
Yeah.
But there have been a lot of photographic evidence presented in regards to the paranormal activity that was happening in the home. There is a picture of what they believe is the dark monk sitting on the stairwells. There's also a picture of a hand coming from the stairwell that seems to be holding some type of rosary. And when you look at this stuff, it's really kind of convincing. If it's not convincing, it's at least really freaky.
Mm-hmm.
But these kinds of things are continuing to happen. As recently as May 2019, a man named Jason Whitman Sentinel photographed the apparition of a devilish child lurking out in front of the home.
Okay.
And you're seeing this house pop up in news all the time. It pops up a lot in the UK news, especially on like the tabloid websites like Mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And so because this house has so much infamy around it, anybody who's really trying to debunk that the poltergeist even exists is up for a really big challenge, because there are a lot of eyewitnesses from the original accounts. At a time where capitalizing on these kinds of paranormal activities was never really a thing, and up until this day, you're having person after person after person claiming to have some kind of evidence or have some kind of an experience in the house. So does the Black Monk really exist? A lot of people seem to think so, and a lot of people seem to have no idea on how to get rid of it. So if you want to go to the Pontefract Poltergeist House, you definitely can. They have all kinds of tours where you can throw your money at and spend a night in the house if you want to, though they don't necessarily recommend it.
Ooh.
Now, a quick shout out to my sources, ghost-story.co.uk, mysteriousuniverse.org, the13thfloor.tv, and hauntedrooms.co.uk. Lots of articles on there. They all kind of cover the same thing, but if you want to get a little bit more in depth with it, if you just search Pontefract Poltergeist, or if you search Black Monk, you'll get a lot of these individual encounters that have accumulated over the years, and you can just go check out the television programs that go and explore the house.
Yeah, and can we post those photos on Instagram that you were talking about?
Oh, hell yeah.
I showed you my photos. You never showed me your photos.
Oh, shit. Well, too late.
Okay, well, I guess I'll check out our Instagram. All right, well, that's how things go, I guess. Thanks, Tyler.
No problem.
That was freaky.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I guess that means that we have come to the special part in the show that I know everybody loves and adores, where I ask you a hard-hitting question, Tyler. What have you learned today?
Well, today I think I came to a sort of a realization, and I wonder if cryptids are almost created to keep kids out of places you don't want them to go. Like, don't go into the dense dark woods because there's a monster in there and it's gonna eat you. Don't go into that deep dark ocean because there's a monster in there and it's going to eat you.
Yeah, that is kind of where these tales come from.
Right?
Yeah.
Cautionary tales.
Yeah.
But with cryptids, that seems to be a common link.
Yeah, a lot of cautionary tales, a lot of morality details. Love a good spooky cryptid story to keep society in check.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess this week I learned, don't fight dirty. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, don't even fight to begin with, but never pull hair.
No.
That's below you. Yeah. All right. Well, that's my lesson of the day.
Perfect.
Thanks. You want to read a review?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I heard you've got a really good one for me this week.
Yes, I do. So this one is called Amazing, and it's by Ray's Jordan. And they say, my boyfriend and I listen while we are in bed. Fabulous podcast.
Is that it?
That's it. Who knew we were bedroom material?
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Ooh, the thought of people fucking to this podcast.
I'm sure that's not what they meant.
What an absolute treat.
Uh-huh.
Well, thanks, Riz Jordan. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great to know we're also pillow talk. All right, well, if you want to send us a cute little review and have it read on this show, you can do just like Riz Jordan did, and you can hop on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you're listening to, rate us 5 stars, and write a cute-ass little review. I swear to Satan, we will read it, and at some point, we will probably read it on the air. Now, if you are looking for another way to support the show and you've got a little bit of cash to throw around and you want to get something really cool for yourself, then you can come join a cult. It's called the Secret Society That Doesn't Suck, and it's our super secret, super sexy little group that we have on Patreon.
Uh-huh.
Over at patreon.com/thatsspooky. Now, no matter what tier you sign up at, you get access to our many episodes called Spooky Snacks.
Yeah.
You also get different perks depending on what tier you sign up at. So you can get some real cute spooky portraits done of yourself or your pet and loved one done by Tyler. You can get merch. You can get a whole bunch of other stuff. Plus, you can get access to our movie nights and our witchcrafting events that we do every month on stream exclusively for the Secret Society That Doesn't Suck members.
That's right, Annie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since we're in the age of the internet, don't forget to follow us on Instagram, especially if you want to go see those ghost pictures that I denied showing Johnny. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go see some footage of the Jersey Devil.
Yeah, it'll be real good.
Mm-hmm. And you can follow us on Instagram and also on Twitter at That's Spooky Pod.
Yeah, that's THATSSPOOKYPOD, which just so happens to be how we spell our email as well. So you can email us at thatsspookypod@gmail.com, and you can send us your own freaky stories, stuff you've lived through that your friends have lived through. Maybe you just got something weird that's happened in your hometown. Maybe you know of a baby that's flown a plane into the Bermuda Triangle. I want to know about it.
Uh-huh.
You can also just send cute pet photos. We love those too, and we encourage them.
We do. And last but not least, go check out our website, thatsspooky.com. You can get show notes there. You can listen to the episodes there. You can send us emails from there. You can do everything you could ever want to do from there.
Yeah, it's pretty beautiful. You can also hop over to thatspooky.com/store or access it through the website and get yourself a spooky bitch enamel pin.
Tis the season to let everybody know what a spooky bitch you are.
It's true. And then you got to figure out gifts for people come December. And you know what? Those make cute gifts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. Anyway, you can go do that at thatspooky.com/store. Now, we've gotten that out of the way. Everybody knows where to find us. Y'all know what to do. I just want to take a moment to say, I love y'all very much.
Me too.
Kissy kisses. And don't forget, if you're going to be a bitch,
be a spooky bitch.
Bye. Bye.